Okay, so it's March 21st, I think.
March 21st.
And we're in Socorro with Cam Wade. Oh, not Socorro, Albuquerque with Cam Wade. And we're going to talk about the early years at NRAO, particularly with respect to the VLA. So as I remember you, when you finished at Harvard, you went to Australia for 2 years.
2 years.
And then you came directly here.
To
Greenbank. Yeah.
And then,
what brought you to Greenbank? Were you recruited or you was on your own?
I've been in correspondence with Dave Heeshan all through that time.
Right.
And so eventually I don't think I asked for a job, though it would have been obvious to anyone I'd like to have it. And so duly it was done. It was a near thing because I think if I'd stayed in Australia another year, I might have stayed down there permanently.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I went down with one child, came back with two, all that. I should caution you before we go further. My memory is not likely to be perfect, and I'm sure of that because the things I have a very clear memory of that I also could not possibly have happened the way I remember them. And with advancing age, one wonders.
Well, I know, but, you know, there are other people. I think I told you, I talk with Dave Heeshan a lot. Oh, that reminds me. I had lunch yesterday with Dave Hogg and Ted Rice.
Oh, very good.
And they both said to say hello.
Well, thank you. Please, when you have the opportunity, return the greeting.
I will do that. We talked to lots of people. And, of course, you know, you try to get the same story from everybody.
Lots of luck. Because I've seen this more and more as I get older. People will both remember the same incident, but they will not remember it the same. And
yesterday at lunch with Ted, it was Dave. He told one story about when Barry and I got tenure together, and the story I had heard was slightly different.
Okay.
Anyway, so you would been to
you'll get the gospel according to Wade.
Yeah,
all right.
But in that interview you had with Robin, you mentioned other offers that you had, or other possibilities beside NRAO.
Oh, at that stage there weren't any that really interested me. I think Caltech was looking for people, but NRAO sounded right, and it was also nearer the part of the country I came from. Ah. And that I come from a rather strong family, so that was a factor. Yeah.
Can I go back? I'm just remembering when we talked with Dave Heeshan, and I think you alluded to this in your interview with Robin, but she didn't know enough of the background to pursue it. You played a major role at Harvard in getting him started in 21 centimeter research.
I probably did. I think I made the difference to tilting the seesaw.
Yeah, what happened?
All right, well, what happened was I came back after serving my country for a couple of years in January of 1952. And while I was in the Army, we were an artillery unit. We did a lot of work with radios. I got interested in radio, and I learned a fair bit about radio as practiced and at that time. And I also had kept up a sky and telescope and things like that while I was playing soldier. And could see that things were happening in the radio part of the spectrum. No expertise, but an awareness of things that were going on there, and this was a new field to plow. And so I came back, as I recall, I talked to Bart Bock, whom I had known slightly before I went off into service.
You had already been a few years at Harvard before you went into the military?
I had 2 years at Harvard.
Ah, okay.
And then they couldn't handle the situation without the 452nd Armored Field Artillery Battalion, of which I was a part. And so they came back, and most of us came back. But anyway, not the same. I had my eyes open to a lot of things. And it was being young and brash and having nothing to lose, and I renewed acquaintance with Bart Bach, who was pretty much my mentor. I began to ask him, why don't we at least look at what you do on the radio? Well, the timing was very good, because that was very near the time when Doc Ewen had gotten the 21-centimeter line at Harvard. And Ed Purcell, who was Doc Ewen's advisor, was a close friend of Bart Bach.
Yeah. So when was this? When did you come back, before or after the...
I think he had already found it.
Right.
And before, I think it was in 51.
Yes, it was 51. You came back.
And I came back in early 52.
Ah.
And so it was all there, but nobody at Harvard had any background. They knew what Ewen had done.
Right.
Because of the connection with interstellar space, Bart Bach was more likely to be interested than people like Menzel and Whipple.
Right.
And so he was more receptive. But I think what I did was to get people with some influence just actually thinking about it, by being brash and asking stupid questions and sort of stuff I'm good at. So that was my contribution, but then I was much involved when they got going. We built that 20-foot dish.
But Dave Heeshan said that you had gone to Ewen to work with him.
Worked for Doc Ewen. That's how I made my money when my first child was on the way. Yeah. But I worked gratis on a lot of that stuff. What we tried to do is adapt the... Well, back up here. They arranged for Dave Heeshan and Ed Lilly, both graduate students, and myself, coming back as a junior, at what should have been my senior year, or the last semester of it. We were designated to go and work with Doc Ewen and learn how to run his equipment. Well, Doc took us down and showed us that, and boy, a lot of the jargon that I had never heard before still sticks with me. For example, when you're the setup procedure on this lab grade equipment, not field grade,
right,
was pretty daunting. And Doc is really slangy. I remember, what does he mean when he says, "We're beating the crystal against a rail"?
Yeah,
I
know what you mean. That's the way we prepare
this kind of thing. So anyhow, we three learned how to get that thing set up and going, and that funnel-shaped horn antenna that's out in front of the Jansky lab, I guess it's still there.
Yep.
Now, stuck out of the window upstairs in Jefferson Hall, the physics building. And that's where we went and learned how to use it. The Doc's equipment was still set up just inside, more or less as he'd used it. Well, that was all great. And then, not sure how we discovered this. I think maybe we went back there, the three of us, to see if we could remember how to set it up, and the room was locked. Well, what happened? Nobody told us. The physics department decided to ship all that equipment down to the Carnegie Institution in Washington. So it disappeared from Harvard. But Doc wanted to build a new receiver and all that. And he did it, and everything was very primitive in those days by modern standards, and much vacuum tube stuff and so on. And one thing led to another. I think it was by December of 1953, we had that small antenna, I believe it was 20, 24 feet in diameter, at Agassiz Station. And we all, again, it was Lilly and Heeshan and myself, largely got everything set up. We did everything from greasing the gears to tuning the electronics. And
where were people like Howard and Menon and Kasem?
Okay, Menon.
Because they were all senior to you, weren't they?
They were ahead of me.
They were graduate students.
They came into that thing later on. Tom Matthews.
Oh, and that's right.
Tom Matthews and Kotu Menon got involved with that small antenna out there. And Howard and Kasem came in later when we had the 60-foot, if I recall. Mm-hmm. We got the, well, we were running the 20, why can't I remember the diameters, 20 or 24 feet. But I think it's gone to China now or something. But it was 1953-54. I lived at Agassiz Station free in return for being janitor. And that was fine. But Haitians were living there in the Agassiz Cottage with their little two-year-old daughter. And I lived upstairs, they lived downstairs. And we all worked together a lot getting that going, 53 into 54. If I recall, it was 54 that Dave and Ed had their oral exams on the same day. But it's not clear who was the first, really the first one, because Ed went first before the board for the oral. He passed, but it was a conditional pass. The condition was that he get learn enough German to pass his exam. So, whereas Dave Heeshen got it all finished off a couple of hours later, you know, all complete.
He had some issue too, because I think he also had a language problem, because he when he left to go to Wesleyan to teach,
but
he said he was supposed to be an assistant professor and they downgraded him because he hadn't completed his.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay, maybe they were in it together. Okay.
Apparently that's something that's burning him up for 50 years that he kept. Yeah.
Well, I never had a problem with German. Older people in my family were speaking it when they could.
And in fact, the date that he gives on his CV for his PhD is not the date that Harvard granted it because of this delay.
Okay, but there's also a scheduling problem. They date their degrees on commencement.
That's right.
And I finished everything 1st of August 1957, but my degree is dated 1958.
Right. I presume you were at the dedication of the 60-foot antenna in 59?
Yes, I was there, and Bart Bach was about to take off for Australia then. And
I was there.
You were there?
I was there.
My God.
I was a freshman at MIT. I was taking an astronomy course. It was taught by a geologist, and he took us out there.
Okay, you and I were breathing the same air, but we didn't. Okay, great. But that was
my first exposure to radio astronomy.
Okay, all right, well.
We had one lecture during this course. It was a guy from BU who later did work on Stonehenge. He was quite well known. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I know, he's an Englishman. He wrote the book on,
yes,
on Stonehenge.
Yes, yes, yes.
Hawkins.
That's right. And he came in, for some reason, he was called in to give a class on radio astronomy.
Yeah. He was a somewhat strange guy.
Yeah,
he's a fun guy, but he's strange.
Okay, anyway, let's get back to the VLA.
Okay.
So I read your 1963 memo, which sort of outlined everything.
Nobody reads that.
Yeah, well.
Remember, you noticed the date it was written?
Yeah.
The day before Kennedy was
shot. Yes, yes.
Nobody's paying any attention.
Yes, I did not appreciate that until I read your interview with
I didn't know anybody had ever read it. Okay,
Dave Heeshen pointed us to it, and he sort of thought that was the beginning.
I went out and spent about 3 weeks at Caltech.
Right.
And that must be where I actually
met that. That's right. In the Owens Valley.
Yeah, I remember Bob Wilson was still a graduate student then.
Yeah, we were there.
And, okay.
So, you're getting a little bit ahead. First, what inspired that memo? Was it Ishan requested this to get something down on paper that you guys were talking about?
All right, my recollection, going back, you certainly know from the interview about the coffee break in 61.
You mentioned that, yeah.
And so this was a thing some people were thinking about. Dave Ishan had a lot on his mind besides the new projects then.
The 140-foot.
The 140-foot was big. We all did. I was trying to get some research done, some papers written, blah, blah, blah. But I think of the members of scientific staff, I was a little more intrigued with this idea than any of the others at the time. Dave Hogg, I think, was a graduate student time. He doesn't remember that meeting, that coffee break, at least didn't the time I talked to him a year or so ago. I remember it very well. I could go point to where the table was in the cafeteria. I tend to have a very geometrical memory, which can be handy. But let's see, back to the thing, writing the thing. I had learned a lot during that visit to Caltech, which was essentially October of 62. And then I went up and spent a couple of days in the San Francisco area, actually down at the place, fiber optics was just coming along.
Well, I was surprised when I read that. I wasn't aware that it was being done that early.
So I visited some industrial places there, and that was the one time I visited the Stanford effort. So I guess Dave Cutterback, lost track of him. Maybe he doesn't live anymore.
I don't know.
He was the one who showed me around because Bracewell was out of town. But anyway, I found it very interesting, but I concluded correctly that we better stick with cable at that stage because it was obvious that technology was A, promising, B, had a hell of a long way to go before it was useful. And I came back, but I'd been thinking about all this array stuff, and I believe when I wrote that thing, I don't even have a copy of it now, I'm pretty sure. I saved very little when I left. I think we were still thinking in terms of just a rectangular array. We hadn't gotten to the point of seeing if that was the best way to do it. Leonard Chaus later on came up with a Y configuration.
By rectangle, you mean a T here?
Or a cross? A T is a subset of a rectangle.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, yeah. You didn't mean... N by M antennas in a rectangle.
No, it was. I was just trying to get a few things down to start from. I'd sort of say, all right, something needs to work on. Let's assume this. Let's and see if we can beat it. And that comes naturally to me. And so we did. It was in the course of that that I realized that the locus in the UV plane. Or two-element interferometer was a true ellipse.
Right.
And that I'm sure other people knew it, but I discovered it for myself.
Total blank.
And it's just because when I wrote those parametric equations, I realized I've seen these before somewhere.
Right, right.
And I think that's where I discovered that there were ellipses in the UV plane. And I can't even recall what all I did there, but I handed it in. And it was circulated, but nobody was thinking about that stuff because of the Kennedy assassination. And I, after all these years, I assumed nobody ever read it.
Dave brought it to my attention. Dave Ishan.
Okay, right.
In his mind, that was sort of the initiation of it.
Okay. Well, as I say, I was writing it down largely for our own benefit, but right. figured so that everybody speaks the same language, I should circulate it.
Mm-hmm.
It was as simple as that. Now, at that point, that was the same week that I turned 33, just to get a scale on it. So I was a lot younger then. That's 51 years ago. Whee!
Well, as you pointed out,
yeah.
everybody was young then.
Yeah.
But I wonder that if it was possible because the science was young.
It was. But you know, can I digress just a moment? I mentioned this the last time I sat down and talked at any length with Dave Heeshan was the 80th birthday
right.
party yep. for George Swenson, mm-hmm. and in fact, invited by the Nichols. And we sat down there in the Nichols house one day, Dave and I, and reminisced a bit. And I ventured to him an idea that I still think has merit. We'd never built the VLA except we were so young. We didn't realize what couldn't be done. So we went out and did it. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, sure it does.
But it, that...
It's true of lots of things. You wouldn't get into it if you knew how difficult it was going to be. Incidentally, George is still going strong.
Yeah, I last saw him there. He was 80.
I talked to him a few months ago.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Okay. He's being in his 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if he's still flying airplanes. He was when he was 80, though. He must have done it right. He's lived to his 90s, yeah.
I asked him. I honestly don't remember the answer.
Huh, okay. No, he bought
but
himself.
He was still working. I mean, he still has his office, and he was still doing mostly in acoustics.
Yeah.
If you remember, he was doing
One of the problems with George was, until you knew him well, he didn't come across as being particularly intelligent.
Yeah.
Then you realize, hell, there's a lot here. But
in that memo, I was interested how you came up with a 82-foot antenna by some diabolical circuitous argument that hindsight is completely irrelevant.
We all had a gut feeling that 25 meters was probably about right.
Okay, so
it's a subjective thing.
Yeah.
However, when it came time to write the proposal, I wrote the chapter on the antenna, went through all this thermodynamic argument to show that given what receiver characteristics, blah, 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 25 meters was reasonable.
But in that memo, you had how long it took to go through one cell in the UV plane was 350 seconds, and therefore you have to be able to...
You remember
to...
more about
it. Well, I just read it.
You just read it. Okay.
And I said, I mean...
I wonder if I'd recognize it.
You came up with the right answer, but...
Well, anyway, just a small digression here. It's not what you're writing about. But, you know, Bob Gelming and I got the first... possibly the first believable stellar radiation using Greenback
astrometer. Yeah, I remember that.
And you know how that started?
I think I did know, but I don't remember.
What it was, I got to wondering here. I was using the equation in the proposal that I derived and figured, you know, can write atmospheric properties on stars and so on. I was thinking first of BE stars because there's something funny going on outside the atmosphere. And, you know, it should be detectable. That was the first coincidence. The second coincidence is I quickly realized that I didn't know enough about stars. So I walked down the hall and said, now pick your brain, Bob. And he got interested. So we got busy and came up with a little wrong answers. But this was just the time the 3-element interferometer is going. And so they turned the 3-element interferometer over to us so we could get it working.
Right.
Well, it turns out the engineers were so good it was working for the first day or so. So we had all this time. We found all sorts of stars that didn't radiate, but we got normal novae. And there's another more story there. You didn't come to talk about that, but the serendipity was terrific.
It was that chapter
of the VLA proposal that I think is where the idea came in my head, and then Bob Gelming picked up right on it and pretty soon was running away with it.
Yeah.
And so but the stellar radio emission is another thing, but it was a byproduct of the VLA proposal, in my opinion. The only person who could dispute it would be Bob Gelmi, and he's not around to do so. So
wait a minute, I'm missing something here. Maybe I was writing something. What did the say it again? What did the VLA proposal have to do with it?
The chapter on antenna, on the antenna, we had to justify 25 meters.
Right.
So I went through all this. It's sort of a theological argument.
Yes.
You know, you start out with the answer and come up with the right questions.
Yeah.
And so it was, that was it. But we divided up the proposal writing. Are you aware of how we did that, George? This was George's idea.
Right.
He. Everybody had chapter or chapters to write. I had two, the site and the antennas, which was largely theoretical. And then each of us gave our chapters to somebody else to rewrite. Mm-hmm. Mine weren't rewritten very much because nobody else knew any more about it than I did.
Right.
Some others got heavily rewritten. But yeah, it was a good approach, though, because it meant that one guy's shortcomings and strengths didn't dominate the chapter. And it was a good idea.
Dave set it up that way, did he?
Well, Dave certainly went along
with it. George.
But I think the idea was George's.
George, right. Okay.
That is my recollection, for what it's worth.
Yeah, no, you said that. That's right.
Yep.
But so you were looking, I still don't get the connection, you were looking to see what sensitivity was needed to detect stars.
Well, why do we have 25-meter antennas?
Right.
To be perfectly honest, we all thought, well, that's reasonable.
They were also available commercially.
The technology for building them accurately existed, so we didn't have to break a lot of new ground to do it.
You had one already.
That's right, we had one. You're exactly right. And then we added to it. Because of the VLA.
Yep.
That's
how
we got into the interferometer.
No, I know that, yes.
And anyway, you've got to keep me from rambling here because you're bringing floods of memories back.
But again, you were looking at what sensitivity you needed to detect the stars?
Yes, and it was an argument, given what we knew would be reasonable. By that time, we knew that radio galaxies were a dominant thing for radio astronomy. For example, we knew that most of these extragalactic sources were double.
The whole VLA proposal was based on that.
It was in the background how do we build an instrument to exploit the doors that are opened by the phenomena we're seeing.
Right.
And you came in and did quite a bit with it, too.
Source counts and everything, yeah.
So this was a lot of interaction.
In 1962, Joe Pozzi visited Green Bank.
Joe Pozzi,
The new director.
Worse than that.
The new director.
That's where his brain tumor asserted itself.
Yes.
I can remember.
Do you remember meeting with him or talking to him?
Oh, very much.
You did.
Well, he was my boss in Australia, remember?
Right.
And I was sitting in my office there upstairs at Gansky Lab. And Pozzi was the prospective new director.
Yep.
And the AUI board had appointed him. He was over there seeing what the deal was. And he had a rather distinctive walk. And I could remember he was quite tall and rather slender. You probably knew him.
Not really, because... Remember, I didn't come to Australia until 63.
Okay.
And so I met him very briefly at the 61 IAU in Berkeley.
Okay.
And I was still a graduate student.
Well, what it was, I was sitting in my office there, and I heard Pozzi coming down, but his walk sounded different.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't sound symmetrical, as it were.
Right, yep.
And that was the day that he realized that something had happened.
Right.
And so, we had Dr. Sweet, neurosurgeon, was one of our trustees. I forget his first name. And
Bill, I think.
Okay, yeah, I guess it was. Yeah,
William,
Bill Sweet.
William Sweet.
Yeah, that's right. And he he immediately, we got palsy to him and diagnosed it, Sweet diagnosed it correctly as a considerable malignant brain tumor. And so he was put in hospital in Washington, D.C., and I forget which hospital it was, it doesn't matter. But I, since I knew him, he'd been my boss for 2 years, they sent me up to be his gopher. And so I was there for that week. And I did gophering for him. And that was the last time I saw him, because then, taken out of my hands, he was flown back to Australia.
Yeah.
It was known that he couldn't be director.
Yeah.
And that was it was in 62.
But after that, he sent the letter. I can't remember whether it was the Eason or Robbie. I think Robbie, maybe it's Eason, but outlining his plans for the observatory. And one of the things he pointed out was the need for an imaging instrument.
Okay, so, I was not aware of that. No.
I was, that was my question, if you...
Yeah, I was not aware of that. No. Remember, I was very low.
Yeah, but... so you don't recall talking to him about that either, then? Or him, talking to you about that?
I do not recall it, that doesn't mean it didn't happen.
No, of course. Well, I know it happened. I'll send you the letter.
Okay. Anyway.
So he had no idea how to, well, he had ideas about how to do it. And he said, you know, he could build a Mills cross, an array like Paul Wilde's ring, or aperture synthesis. And that project was to be his, you know, the main thing. So I'm wondering to what extent. But you were already doing something about it before that.
I was, and in fact, Pawsey, when I was at Caltech in 62, Pawsey had gone back to Australia, where he died, right around that time. And I was in the airport in San Francisco to come back east. I'd finished my bit down in Silicon Valley on the waveguides, not waveguides, the fiber optics. And I was in the bookstore there finding something to read on the cross-country flight, and Dave Heeshan tapped our shoulder. He was on his way to Australia at that point. I think Pawsey died either just before or just after Dave got there. I don't recall the time. I wasn't there, but talk about a coincidence again. So,
I was just wondering.
You'll never finish if I keep.
Yeah, I was just wondering how much influence he had.
He had very little on me directly.
Right, but
indirectly. I think Joe Pawsey's the one who first realized that Fourier transforms.
Oh, yes.
I believe that idea was his first.
Yeah, you know his famous sentence in the paper. I mean, there was a paper, and he showed that the Clif interferometer, and that what you were observing was one component of the Fourier transform, but then he dismissed it, saying you can't change the height of the Clif.
Well, that's when they're using the Clif interferometer.
Yeah, he says you can't change the height of the Clif. So
that's right, but still, that was a...
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Recognition.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that's underlies the whole VLA.
So, the Caltech visit. Did Dave send you there? What was the purpose? To find out about interferometry?
I think someone at Caltech, Dave must have been talking to someone. It might have been Bolton. It probably was Bolton.
It had to be Stanley. Bolton left at the end of 61.
Oh, he did. Okay. Or it meant Stanley, I suspect. Or it might have been someone like Greenberg. I don't know.
Greenstein. Greenstein.
Greenstein, yes. Yeah. You see, my memory.
That's right.
I also have some dyslexia, so it don't get in here. Anyway, Jesse Greenstein probably is the one.
I see.
Now, I think it suggested to Dave that we ought to have somebody out there to learn to take advantage of what they were learning with their 90-footers.
Yeah, I think Jesse was on the visiting committee or something.
That is probably right. And the recollection is very dim on this. But I think Dave asked me if I'd be interested in going on that. The reason he asked me probably is I think I was, of all the people on the scientific staff, the one who was most interested in it at that stage.
Right.
There's something about the concept that grabbed. And it's not that I was any better, I was just there.
Well, I realized you were the one that was working on it. So what'd you learn, Caltech? That turned out to be useful?
It was a great learning experience, and a lot was going on in parallel. For example, it's the first time I ever saw a working interferometer because I didn't participate in any of the Australian interferometry. Most of that had happened before I was down there, in fact, very early. But that was something. Another thing that impressed me very heavily, I couldn't get away, was how they were going about it the hard way, manually reducing all these charts with fringes on them.
Yeah.
And I immediately thought, that ain't the way to do it. And it was in 64 that I wrote the memo about how, it's one of the memo series we had in 64, I'm sure, about how we could make the computer get the fringes out for us.
I see.
And I think that could be behind the way we still do it. I don't know. Barry Clark came out and followed up my memo with a memo of his own. He arrived right after I wrote that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a memo of his own. I had ignored what happened if you didn't have an even number of cycles in these things. That's what happens with any case of Fourier analysis where you have a rough cutoff. But he started out, he said something in effect in his memo that I had a good idea there. He wanted to show how to make it better. Memorable phrasing. And he was right, of course. But that, if I have to look back and think of something I did that was really worth having, that might be it.
So was Greenbank already doing computer recording data on punch tape, I guess?
Well, this was just the time we were getting the interferometer going. We hadn't really developed a working. Nigel Keane was there.
Yeah, but even the 300-foot, how was data taken there? You were one of the early users.
We had an awful lot of charts.
He was, okay.
I don't think we'd really computerized it yet, but what I wanted to do was get it in so that all this work with rulers and pieces of paper spread over the floor could be avoided. That wasn't the way to get any science done.
Well, I spent a year doing that.
But that hit me at Caltech a year and a half earlier.
Right.
When it came to writing that memo, I'll never forget this. It's the only time in my life I ever did this. We'd all gone to bed. We were living down in Greenbank in a gray house. And I'd been wondering a lot about how the hell you do it. I was lying there, got to thinking about it, and it hit me. I had this matter, forget exactly how I set it up. I don't know if you even know the memo. Unless I won't not try to dig up the details. But anyway, by the time maybe 4 o'clock I went to sleep, I had composed the entire report. I got up first thing in the morning, wrote out a rough version, then checked it later after I'd had some breakfast. Lo and behold, I think this will work.
Uh-huh.
But it's the only time in my life I've ever had that experience. But I think it was because a lot was going on in the subconscious for quite a while beforehand and began to float up. So anyway, that was momentous for me, and I think it did open a lot of doors at a critical time because we're on the point of pulling in data. And this manual
that was with the Greenbank in front.
Yes, two elements.
Yeah, I know.
Summer of 64, we got that going. and learned a hell of a lot. I keep interrupting myself. This is what happened when you run stream of consciousness. So you keep it up. It's nearly 3 o'clock. I don't think Marianne's here yet, but well, we've got 2 hours until the dining room.
So that was from the beginning, the Green Bank Interferometer, I had tape, magnetic tape recording.
It was magnetic tape, and it was magnetic tape for a long time because we were shipping those tapes over to Charlottesville after we made the move.
And, yes, I remember. Tape
was it for quite a while.
Yeah, well, I was doing the same thing in 140 foot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's turn to the site selection.
I'm sorry?
The site selection.
Oh, site selection, okay.
So, what I read in your interview was you sort of had picked the plains of St. Augustine right from the beginning, from just inspection of maps and everything, and then went through a long, long process to make it official.
I think she's taking a nap. Let me go get something.
Okay.
Really, because I want to talk about site selection.